From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. The LA Unified School Board is gearing up to vote today on a union-approved agreement that ended the teacher strike. But the County Office of Education, well, it says the deal isn't financially sustainable for the district. We'll hear how that may factor into the vote. Plus, how an LA soul food spot is making healthy eats without sacrificing traditional flavor. It's all coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Hope you're having a good day. It's a nice day out there today, so hopefully your day is going as nice as well. Now, lots going on today on the local level. LA City Council is meeting, and so is the County Board of Supervisors. In about 20 minutes, we're going to catch you up on how county supervisors have admonished new LA Sheriff Alex Villanueva for reinstating a controversial deputy. First, though, to the school board. A meeting is now underway to vote on the new teachers' contract hammered out last week between LAUSD officials and the union United Teachers Los Angeles. And moments ago, they voted to approve the contract. But LA County's Office of Education is criticizing the contract for not being financially sustainable on an ongoing basis. For more on all this, we have KPCC's Kyle Stokes. He's currently outside the school board meeting in downtown. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, A.
All right, so we talked about this last week when details of the agreement was coming out. The county had raised serious concerns about the district's finances before the contract was passed. What are the questions it raised today?
Well, the questions that it raised today are about how it pays for some of the most expensive components of the contract. We sort of knew that this was going to be coming down the line. The county obviously having those serious concerns already. The superintendent, Austin Buettner, has said more revenue is going to be needed to pay for some of this new agreement with United Teachers Los Angeles, and so have members of the mayor's staff, which helped facilitate this deal between the teachers union and the school district. So we sort of knew that there were going to be questions about how it was going to be paid for. The question was going to be, was the county going to step in and step up its response? Because already the county has said they've appointed a fiscal expert to come into the school district and monitor the district's finances. They have to put together a cost-cutting plan to show how they're going to absorb these new costs. And so the question now, and I think that this is sort of a signal from the county that this is going to be a real tightrope the district is going to have to walk when it shows how it's going to absorb those costs.
But if the county has doubts and it's going to be a tightrope, I mean, what is that going to mean down the line for this contract moving forward?
Well, so what the district has said is essentially that, and what the mayor's staff has said as well, is that if the two sides don't come up with some new revenue source, then they will have to get with the teachers union and renegotiate the terms of this contract. There are, especially in the start of the year 2021, the school year in 2021, there are a lot of new costs that kick in, and the money to pay for those new costs, including class size reduction, more nurses and other staff members, the money isn't there for that right now. The mayor and the union and the district have framed this as, well, we've got to go out and find new revenue. What the county is saying is that you can't just say that. You have to talk about how you're going to absorb the costs without the possibility of new revenue. In other words, where are you going to cut from in order to make all of this be paid for? So what the district would say is, we're going to work on it. We've got this longer runway to figure out where the money is going to come from. The county obviously is now raising questions about whether that's a good course of action.
I think there is a collective sigh going on with any LAUSD parents out there. I'm wondering if there's a timeline for this working out, because it would be a big bummer for this whole thing to fall apart, Kyle.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's not over yet. So by March, the district has to work with this fiscal expert, and they've got to submit this cost-cutting plan. They've got to show how they're going to absorb the new costs of this deal on top of some other cuts that they need to make in terms of balancing their books for the rest of this year and for the coming 3 years. They write their budget on a three-year basis. So March is going to be a key inflection point. That report is due. The county has the power to take even more serious interventions. They could could step in with something up to, something that looks like a county takeover. It's possible that they could say, we don't think that this plan is sufficient. And then what they would do, it's possible that the county could appoint an official with the power to override school board decisions, invalidate budgets, and call into serious question this contract. In other words, throw out the contract. So the district is walking a tightrope here.
All right, one more item on the agenda today. All right, that's a group shouting earlier today saying no charter ban. The board is expected to vote on a resolution to ask the state legislature to put a cap on charter schools. Clearly, Kyle, the crowd not happy about it. What was it all about?
Well, so not a cap was the original language that came out of the deal with the teachers union. The teachers union is part of its settlement agreement to end this strike. Recently said that they wanted to have the school board vote on a resolution to put a cap on charter schools. What they're voting on today, and in fact what public commenters are up at the microphone as we speak here discussing right now, is whether or not there should be a quote-unquote temporary moratorium placed on the opening of new charter schools. This is a symbolic resolution for the district's part, but as you say, Abe, this is going to have to be something that state lawmakers would ultimately act on, and there are some pretty prominent state lawmakers who have already voiced support for a temporary moratorium, including Governor Gavin Newsom. If they go forward, if the school board goes forward with this resolution, that would be a pretty powerful nudge to those state lawmakers to make that temporary moratorium a reality.
All right, you mentioned symbolic. Say the board votes yes on this resolution. What does that really mean anyway?
Well, I think obviously that would be, in addition to being a nudge to state lawmakers, it's also kind of, I think charter school supporters would say it is sort of a slap in the face. It also sort of, especially because the people who are on the school board right now, the school board members are, most of them at one point or another have been endorsed by the California Charter Schools Association and have often been, described as a pro-charter board. So the symbolism here goes beyond just like advocating for state lawmakers. It really goes to show how the politics around charter schools is shifting underneath everyone's feet. And it means a lot to the one out of every five students in LA who's enrolled in a charter school that's outside of LAUSD's direct control. And so it has more than just a symbol as a matter of like urging state legislation. I think a lot of charter supporters, if this passes, would take this as a real slap in the face. But teachers union members, just as clearly view charter schools as an existential threat to LAUSD. And they want this to be in place because they feel like the unregulated growth of charter schools is a real risk to the future of LAUSD.
That's KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And we'll continue to update you on the latest news with LA schools on KPCC and our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. All right, moving to the mountains now. The government shutdown is over for now, but some areas are still feeling the effects. National parks are still trying to clean up after being closed for weeks. Paramount Ranch in the Santa Monica Mountains was once a popular filming location for Western movies and TV shows. But the area was devastated by last year's Woolsey Fire, and then came the government shutdown, which furloughed park employees. Now, they're back on the job and once again working to recover from the fire. Now, this morning, we took a trip out to see how things are looking. Kate Kirkendall is with the National Park Service, and she showed us around.
Paramount Ranch is a very beloved place for many members of the public that have been coming here for generations. And it's also a site that recently burned in the Woolsey Fire.
It's pretty chewed up still. I mean, the trees are black. Hey, there's damage all over the place. I mean, we're looking at this is bad.
Yes, it's very devastating. And what we're looking at now is Western Town. And we used to have basically a whole movie set of buildings that have been used for, movies and TV shows, and then there's really only two buildings that survived the fire. And so that one right there is the chapel. That's kind of a new addition. And that's actually from the Westworld show. They built that for their first season. And then what we call the train station over there also survived.
Now, what were you guys in the middle of when the government shutdown happened?
Yeah, so I mean, the timing was crazy because we, you know, just sort of suffered through this major fire that burned 88% of the National Park Service land in the Santa Monica Mountains. And we have a lot to do after the fire, right? You can see all these burn structures that we have here. And these are hazardous materials that need to be cleaned up. And we need to go through a federal contracting process to clean up these materials. And we have about 30 structures in the park that burned. Another really huge impact is our trails. We had about 100 miles of trail burn, some quite severely. And so we still have a lot of trail closures. Not being here, we weren't able to continue working on that sort of thing. But we're, you know, obviously going to get to it as soon as we can.
And that work piled up, right? I mean, there's no one doing anything.
Oh, right. No, nobody was doing the trail work. Yeah.
So who exactly was furloughed, though? Who couldn't do anything during the shutdown?
We have about 90 employees who work at this park, and everyone was furloughed except for our law enforcement staff, which is about 9 or so employees. And so they're what is called essential to protecting public safety and also the resources of the park. So we are very grateful to them because we especially need them after a fire, because the biggest challenge is after the fire trying to keep people out of the closed areas and, you know, off of the natural landscape, because they do really permanent damage. And after a fire, that's obviously when the landscape is most vulnerable.
Were you furloughed? You were furloughed.
Okay.
So I'm wondering for you, Kate, knowing what needs to be done here on a daily basis, were you thinking, okay, that area, were you already kind of planning ahead of time? When I get back, I'm going to have to do this, I'm going to have to do that. Did you have it in a checklist in your head?
Yeah, there's definitely a sense of urgency coming, especially right after the fire. And just like the community, we're impacted too. We have 3 employee families that lost their homes, and they actually were living in park housing. So right over there, you can see the washer and dryer remains. So we had a family that lived right there in Western Town and, you know, kind of looked after the place, you know, after hours and everything. And so they've been displaced by the fire as well, and trying to find the next place to live in and everything. And then the government shutdown happens. And so that's been really difficult and a lot for the staff to go through.
Now, when it comes to the cleanup, you mentioned, and we're seeing all this stuff that does need to get cleaned up. How long is it going to take to do that now?
Yeah, it's going to be a multi-year process for sure. Because, I mean, not only do we have to, like, for example, get rid of all this debris here, which is, we can't just come and load it up. You know, there's a sort of a public health process for how to handle that. But also we want to rebuild Western Town. After the fire, we launched a campaign with our park friends group, the Santa Monica Mountains Fund, to rebuild Paramount Ranch and to really try and tap into the entertainment industry and the people that love this place to get them to help us raise funds to rebuild it. This is also the number one source of revenue for this park. We don't charge entrance fees at this park, and we have very little camping fee money. So the filming and the special events like weddings and bar mitzvahs and memorials and all those things that take place at Paramount Ranch is a big source of revenue for the park and helps pay for some of the salaries of some of our staff.
The little critters that live around here, what about recovery for them? I know that there's been some issues with bobcats as well. So what's going on with them?
That's one of the things we really want to learn about and understand better. And, you know, not being at work is, you know, a missed opportunity for data collection and understanding those kinds of things, because we've never had a fire in the Santa Monica Mountains that burned this many acres in the Santa Monica Mountains. So we really don't know exactly how this is impacting the wildlife. Certainly for a lot of the smaller little animals, you know, we know that we saw many, for example, dead rabbits and dead wood rats and that kind of thing that weren't able to escape the flames. And typically for the bigger animals, they can outrun the flames. But we had one mountain lion that we believe did not outrun the flames and died. We had another mountain lion we were following that survived the initial fire but died a couple weeks afterwards and, you know, had burned paws. And then, as you mentioned, there was a bobcat right before the shutdown that we had got some photos and some local residents had told us was looking very mangy, and we were in the process of trying to capture that animal, and we were not able to do so before the shutdown happened. And we were notified later that some residents found this bobcat and it had died. It was one of our collared bobcats. So, you know, that obviously is disappointing.
Now, okay, so
right now, mm-hmm. the government is open.
Yes.
You're back. Everyone is back.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of schedule are you on to just kind of get things back to where you had them before?
Yeah. Well, our first day back was yesterday, and literally the whole day was spent making sure that our employees get paid as quickly as possible, because although the government is back, our employees still are not paid yet. We expect that employees will be able to see their past two paychecks in their bank accounts on Wednesday. So that was the number one priority for yesterday. But as we look forward, you know, our priorities are first to take care of employees, you know, and second, our big priority is to reopen as much of the park as possible as safely as we can. So although we're open in the sense that the shutdown is over, we still have many closed areas due to the fire. So some of our most popular places, like portions of the Backbone Trail, still remain closed. And so we have a lot of trail work to do. And then the third thing is, you know, just the longer term vision for rebuilding. So when we stand here at Western Town, we say, you know, what will the next version of this look like?
Okay, thank you very much for having us out here and showing us around.
Thanks for coming out to Paramount Ranch.
That was Kate Kirkendall with the National Park Service. Earlier this morning, she showed us around Paramount Ranch so we could see how it's recovering from the Woolsey Fire and a month without maintenance due to the government shutdown. All right, now, while pot is legal in California, for many, the price of the pot is too darned high. Taxes on marijuana get the bulk of the blame, but there are other issues when it comes to buying bud. All that and more is being talked about at the North American Cannabis Summit right here in LA. We'll hear what they're talking about when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. And I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The LA County Board of Supervisors took a highly unusual step today. It questioned newly elected Sheriff Alex Villanueva about a deputy he rehired after that deputy was terminated for domestic violence and stalking. Supervisors raised concerns the sheriff was sending the wrong message about how he views domestic violence and had changed the standard for what got a deputy fired. Supervisors raised their concerns in a motion at the meeting, as well as a face-to-face with the sheriff who attended. Sheriff Villanueva was unmoved. KPCC's Frank Stoltz covered the meeting. He's here with us now. Hello, Frank.
Hey.
All right. How rare is it for the LA County supervisors to do something like this?
It's really rare. The five members of the board don't have a lot of authority over the sheriff. They allocate the sheriff's $3.4 billion budget, make long-term decisions on big-ticket items like the downtown jail. But the sheriff is independently elected, not accountable to the Board of Supervisors. They may raise concerns, about the behavior or policies of a high-ranking official in the department, but almost always in private between supervisors, deputies, and aides to the sheriff. Nothing public like we saw today.
Now, why are they so concerned about this?
Well, Deputy Carl Mandian was accused of physically assaulting his girlfriend in 2014 and stalking her. A prosecutor said there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute him, to file a crime against him, but former Sheriff Jim McDonald fired him. Domestic violence is a crime of moral turpitude that the law considers an indication someone might lie, and that's the last thing, of course, you want is a dishonest cop. Fast forward to last year's campaign for sheriff, Mandorian was a trusted volunteer member of Villanueva's campaign. Villanueva rehired him as a deputy, saying McDonald unfairly targeted him. It's raised big concerns, because among the reasons he's given is that the woman didn't follow through on the allegations, even though that's very common in domestic violence cases. He also said the department should not get caught up in domestic quarrels, which he described to the Civilian Oversight Commission last week as messy. Here's Supervisor Sheila Kuehl at today's meeting.
The larger question really is the public trust, the trust of this board. And perhaps it would also be good for you to take into account the trusts of our contract cities, because there are several large areas, as you know, on which we count on the sheriff to be there for us.
I should note that this is the first majority female board of supervisors we've ever had. And obviously it comes amidst the Me Too movement. So there's lots of sensitivities to these issues. Other concerns, too, the sheriff says the department has long engaged in cronyism. Now he rehires his campaign aide. He also did not include the county's inspector general in the process of the rehiring, even though the IG specifically asked him to be included.
Now, what was Sheriff Villanueva's response?
He said the supervisors had it wrong. He said Mandoyan got a raw deal from the previous sheriff's internal affairs investigators.
The standard within the department in internal investigations was altered. If there's a dispute between employees and you say that employee lied and the investigator talks to both, they say, well, I think I like what they said. I don't like what you said. You're guilty of false statements.
And the sheriff makes broad accusations in this regard, saying that many people were fired unfairly. And he was unconvinced his actions would have any effect on how women inside and outside the department view the agency in terms of trusting it to report domestic violence.
You're going to have an entirely different perspective on that. I promise you that.
Yeah, well, I look forward to that.
So he's promising that the supervisors, when given more information, will have a different view, and that was Supervisor Q following him. In fact, the sheriff didn't buy much of anything the supervisors told him today. And he pointed out there was a six-fold increase in firing under former Sheriff McDonald, who was brought in to clean up the department. That's been McDonald's explanation that the department needed cleaning up.
That's exchange between Kuehl and Villanueva sounded tense. What did the other supervisor have to say?
Yeah, it was tense. I mean, these are all very powerful people, the five members of the board, the sheriff, and they usually have a cordial relationship with them because they want good patrols in their districts. The board is fairly liberal, but supervisors across the political spectrum raise concerns. Supervisor Catherine Barger represents the conservative North County. She pointed out the Civil Service Commission that reviews sheriff's terminations more often than not finds in favor of the employee. And the vote to uphold the firing of this deputy accused of domestic violence was unanimous. Supervisor Hilda Solis, maybe the board's most liberal member, represents the east side where Villanueva, by the way, got his strongest support. She expressed surprise that Villanueva wasn't really in tune with the issue of domestic violence, how women feel about it.
I think that we really have to understand what is happening in the environment around us. And that environment is very sensitive right now.
She's referring to the Me Too movement. This is the first ever Board of Supervisors, I mentioned, dominated by women, and I think that's driving some of this.
All right, so what's next with all this?
Well, the board voted to send a letter to Villanueva expressing concern over his rehiring of this deputy. The letter requests that Villanueva reconsider the action. They can't make him. He indicated today he would not do that, though. The board also asked the county lawyer in the county council's office to examine some of the legal issues surrounding the reinstatement. And importantly, the supervisors also want to get a waiver from the deputy so they can access confidential personnel files regarding this case and make their own judgment. Clearly, they are now wary of this new sheriff if they weren't already. A majority supported the incumbent. The incumbent had a lot of experience. Villanueva is a retired lieutenant, and he feels like he got a lot of raw deals at the department, not getting promotions above lieutenant. And so there seems to be a new level of concern about Villanueva at the five-member Board of Supervisors.
All right, that's KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Frank, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. The sale of recreational marijuana has been legal in California for a little more than a year, but the rollout has hardly been smooth. There are still lots of concerns around black market sales, taxation levels for the legal stuff, and the accurate measurement of THC levels. Many of those concerns are being addressed in L.A. this week as part of the North American Cannabis Summit. Rosalie Pakula is senior economist and co-director of the Drug Policy Research Center at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica. She'll be speaking at today's Cannabis Summit. Rosalie, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you very much for having me,
eh? All right. Now, the sale of recreational marijuana has been legal for just over a year now. What would you say has gone right with that and what's gone wrong?
Well, we have managed to move some of what was previously illegally sold into a legal market, as is indicated by growing tax revenues. We have been able to put into place some regulations to try to guarantee the quality and integrity of the product that was being consumed. And with the resources of the revenue generated from the market, we've been able to begin efforts to do campaigns to educate consumers of the potential risks of inappropriate use, things like impaired driving and the like.
Now, what about what's gone wrong?
Well, I would say clearly we didn't initiate the market and immediately get rid of the black market. But I think that would have been a naive idea if anybody really thought that that would happen immediately. It takes time for a legal market to displace an illicit market, particularly when the legal market is coming in and imposing some additional costs in the production of the good that's being sold and now having to compete with the black market.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry, Rosalie, but yeah.
So I think that's the primary concern. And then obviously it's taken a lot of time for this to roll out. And the uncertainties of some of the regulations and how it would pan out has obviously created some discomfort on the industry side.
So let's get into those taxes a little bit, because one of the big reasons to legalize marijuana, what the argument was to be able to tax it. Some people say it's too taxed, which might explain why some are going with the cheaper black market product. Now there's a proposal in the state legislature to reduce the state sales tax on marijuana from 15 to 11%. What can you tell us about that?
Correct. So I would again argue, yes, we knew that the legal market would produce a product that would be slightly more expensive than the black market, but we were accepting that when we decided to legalize, because the trade-off was having a product of known quantity and purity that the consumer could use and have the knowledge and comfort that it was a safer product than what was being traded on the black market. So there was a trade-off that was supposed to be implicit there. There are other ways that we've raised the price. Obviously, our licensing fees and the regulatory hurdles that we impose with the testing all impose cost to producers. However, changing from black market to a legal market did reduce the risk of production. So on average, we still see that prices have in general been falling. So the cost of production in general is cheaper, but it's cheaper to both the black market producers as well as the legal market producers. Colorado was concerned about this and with their tax, and in 2017 actually proposed a reduction in their state sales tax as a way to try to compete, because they've had an ongoing problem with their black market, even with legalization. And while they saw with the decrease in the state tax, a bit of an uptick in state tax revenue from marijuana, which they presumed was an indication that people were moving into the legal market, scholars aren't 100% sure that that's really the full explanation, because at the same time, there was a number of other policies that also were trying to tackle the black market. So there's more than one lever that can be used to try to move people from the black market to the legal market. Taxation is just one of them, and we're not convinced that that's actually the best one to use, given that there's actual cost involved in regulating the legal market, and that cost has to be paid for somehow.
And as you mentioned, for California voters, that kind of wasn't the point, right, to eliminate the black market.
Yeah, it was a concern that it existed, and there was a desire to get some revenue from a market that already existed, but I don't think it was the primary criteria for legalization. The primary criteria that I understood was the ability to put into a legal regulated system a product that was generally perceived to be not that harmful and so could be exchanged in markets with better certainty of the product and a better revenue to help deal with potential side effects of misuse of that product.
Now, other than lowering taxes for legal marijuana, what mechanisms could be used maybe to diminish the black market?
So one of the tools that actually has been implemented in Colorado as well is a reduction in the number of home cultivation plants that individuals are allowed to use. With our regulation that was in place put in place just about a year ago, the recreational market imposed a plant limit for home cultivation of 6 mature plants, which was a sizable reduction in home cultivation. However, we have a loophole in the state with our medical market. While technically our medical market still has a 6-plant limit, can go up to 12 plants, doctors can give permission for patients to grow much more than that based on the condition that they have their medical recommendation for. So 24 plants all the way up to 99 plants if they have a condition that Dr. Dean requires more plants. Usually cancer patients do in fact need a lot of cannabis to deal with the serious pain that they have. But I would argue that most cancer patients who are in those throes of the pain don't have the energy to take care of 99 plants.
Rosalie Pakula is senior economist and co-director of the Drug Policy Research Center at RAND Corporation in Santa Monica. Rosalie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, if you've never tried it, soul food tastes blow your mind good. Now, the thing is, if it's traditionally prepared, you might have a problem with the calories and cholesterol that come with reusing cooking lard. Well, there's a soul food spot in L.A. that's bucking tradition but keeping it tasty. We'll head over there coming up when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, let's talk about soul food. A quick web search turns up no less than 400 results in Los Angeles alone. Now, with so many choices, it might be hard to know where to go. So, writer Jay Connor did the hard work for you. He penned the article, Where to Eat Soul Food in LA Right Now, for a website, LAist.com. But hey, we wanted to try out some soul food for ourselves. So last week, Jay and I took a trip out to the restaurant My Two Cents on Pico to get a taste of some SoCal soul.
Can I tell you what jumps out at me right off the bat? Oxtail tacos.
Yes.
You were smiling as I was saying it, so you had to know that that was going to get my attention. Why is it such an attention grabber?
Primarily just because it's a fusion of different types of cuisine. You know what I mean? Traditionally, oxtail you associate with, you know, soul food and things of that nature, and tacos, obviously Mexican. So I think that's probably why it caught your eye.
You mentioned, Jay, how it fuses different types of cuisine. Is that essential? Is that the kind of the roots of soul food?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, you know, when it comes to soul food specifically, it's a hybrid, a synthesis of European, indigenous, and African cuisine. And as far as the history of it, it's rooted in the inhumane rations that the enslaved people were given. From that, you had the undesirable parts of pigs, which meant that they were eating ham hocks, which meant they were eating neck bones, which meant that they were eating chitlins. You have ingredients like okra. You have ingredients such as rice and greens that came over as a byproduct of the transatlantic slave trade. So when you combine all that stuff, and then you look at the fact that they had to cook this stuff in a manner in that they were able to get the calories necessary to survive the inhumane treatment that they dealt with as a result of being enslaved. So, yeah, it's definitely a synthesis of all these different things.
Now, when it comes to My Two Cents, why did this place make your list?
It's just great. I mean, if you ask anybody, excluding myself, if you ask anybody, like, hey, what's one of the best places out here? My Two Cents is always going to come up, and especially because there's always a chance you'll run into a celebrity here, too, as well.
All right, Jay, we have a much more important person sitting next to you. So we're going to leave you aside for a second. Chef Elisa, also owner of My Two Cents. First of all, thank you for having us out here.
Thank you. Welcome.
Now, this particular place, why did you choose this place right here on Pico Town to have your restaurant?
I'm a native of L.A., and this was a sweet spot when I was a kid. Plus, it had cheap rent in 2013, so that's what I was looking for.
Cheap rent. Well, that, you know, that's everyone loves cheap rent, especially in Los Angeles. Did you feel that maybe this area needed a soul food restaurant or another soul food restaurant?
Not necessarily. Well, I don't consider my food straight down the middle soul food. So did I think that this restaurant needed to happen somewhere in L.A.? Yes, because a lot of soul food doesn't have the take on it that I put on it, such as the gluten-free options, the vegan options in terms of, say, black IPs. Most black IPs come with meat in them. Most of the traditional elements of the vegetables I found had some type of meat in them. So that element, as well as just making a place where everybody can go. I wanted it to be in a place where it was easy to get to from the north side, the south side, the west side. So it was a good area in terms of the middle of the road.
When you mentioned that you didn't want to go traditional necessarily with soul food, and for people of color, diabetes, weight issues are
all of that.
Was that one of the reasons why you structured your menu the way you structured it?
100%. I'm classically French trained. I made French food most of my career. And I just wanted to do something that was progressive in the area of American comfort food.
You mentioned like things like oxtail tacos.
Right.
A fusion of different cultures in a way. How much did that go into what you got going
on? Well, exactly. So being from L.A., we have a lot of different cultures, obviously. So, and we're a taco-crazed city. So I wanted to make a taco that, it was actually between this and frog leg tacos. I had made them both and I decided on oxtail.
All right, so what do you suggest we try? I mean, we looked at the menu, we almost want to try everything, but
well,
we
that's what people
narrow
say.
It down for us.
People always say, well, what should we try? And I said, well, you should work your way from the top to the bottom.
Top to the bottom.
The first visit usually takes 3 days.
3 days. Well, but, I mean, the oxtail tacos got my eye the second
to.
I saw it.
Yeah, we braise that for 9 hours until it falls off the bone. Rub it with rosemary, our special seasoning that we have, and fresh garlic, beer, Guinness, and orange juice.
So I'm trying the oxtail tacos. That's my choice.
I would
your
say
choice.
The shrimp and grits, because that is one of our most popular. If you Google it, apparently we have the best shrimp and grits in L.A. So.
All right. I think we've got we're set up. Chef, thank you very much for having us out. I think we're going to start trying stuff.
Get in here. Let's go.
Wait, what is this right here?
It's a turkey meatloaf burger.
Turkey meatloaf burger.
Mm-hmm. And then this is shrimp and grits.
We're about to get our life.
Grits.
Together.
Thank you.
All right.
We're about to get our life.
All right, so Jay, so what we have in front of us,
yes.
Crispy turkey meatloaf burger. This was a surprise item. Fresh house-made meatloaf, Japanese breadcrumb, shaved apples, red cabbage, slaw. It looks amazing. Texas toast to go on top
Texas
of it.
Texas toast.
So let's...
Anything that's in between Texas toast, you know it's going to be banging.
I know, so let's give it a shot. Let's give it a try here.
That is perfectly balanced. Wow. Crispy, flavorful, juicy, all the way through.
Absolutely. And it's light.
Yeah. Sometimes sandwiches suffer from the not the right bread for the sandwich syndrome. That is not the case with this thing. Mm-hmm. You mentioned how light it is. Part of it has to do with the bread is not overpowering the sandwich.
And it's got that crunch to it because of that Texas toast. Mm. If this was in like a regular bun, it wouldn't be the same.
No. We're at My Two Cents here on Pico Boulevard, right in the middle of LA. We just had the crispy turkey meatloaf burger. Now, Jay, what are we going to have next?
Next, we're having the succulent shrimp and grits. My favorite thing here.
Your favorite thing here. Okay.
My favorite thing here.
All right.
Although I don't know that meatloaf burger.
I know, and you might have to revise your list, Jay,
right?
In just a moment.
Yes, sir. This isn't a meal. This is a spiritual experience. That's what this is. You look like you just caught the Holy Ghost.
Well, no, yeah, because think about okay. So for people that maybe aren't seafood people,
yeah,
and that think, well, shrimp is hit or miss. I don't know how possibly this could be a miss. Again, like just like with the sandwich, there's a ton of balance between the shrimp. And the liquid, is, I mean, it's like it's perfectly, perfectly placed. Every item perfectly placed. And then when it's all together, it's perfectly placed.
It's amazing.
In the
it's yeah. amazing. Yeah, wow. It's light. It's fresh. It's filling.
You said that twice, too, light. And that's exactly what's going on. And that's Chef's idea, right, for this menu, is to be as light as possible so that you don't feel like you're loaded down and heavy.
That's the biggest thing, because usually when you eat soul food, you're knocked out for the rest of the day. You're done. Yeah. You know, you need a good 3-4 hours just to digest. But after you eat this, I feel like I go shoot some hoops or something like that.
This is fuel for the body, soul, the mind, everything.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
A little bit of Parmesan.
Everything. Wow. All right, Jay, now to the item that caught both of our attention. And you've never tried these, right? The oxtail tacos.
Yeah.
All right. So according to the description, and Chef even mentioned it, six-hour braised kosher natural oxtail, shredded kale, for all the public radio listeners out there, that's kale. It's a religion. Roasted tomato, whiskey reduction.
Correct.
All right. I had to close my eyes because that's what it does to you. Two things combined to make one great thing.
You know how they say that the meat falls off the bone?
Yep.
I felt like the meat fell off my tongue. It's just so so succulent. Like, it's just like, oh, man. And it's so flavorful, even with the kale on it. Because generally people are kind of, you think kale and, like, oxtail, like, that's a weird combination. But
and I'm so glad lettuce isn't on this.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference to have the kale on it.
Absolutely.
Plain old lettuce.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Well,
okay, Chef. Okay.
Tell me.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Right?
We knew this
I'll start paying myself now.
We knew this
it's
was
official.
Soul food, Chef, but you didn't say it would be soul-changing and soul-altering.
Right. Well, it will change your life.
Wow.
I've heard everything from foodgasmic to just pure on insanity.
So let's just say someone's listening to this and is interested, but still worried. You know, it's still maybe they've never had soul food and they don't know, you know, what to expect.
Right.
What's the one thing you would tell someone to be adventurous and to come out here and try it?
I would say open your mind. It's closer to your heart than you think.
Chef, thank you very much for having us out here.
Thank you, guys. Come back, please.
Jay Conner wrote about this restaurant and a lot of other great soul food restaurants in L.A. on our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Jay, thanks for showing us this place and having us out here with you.
It was a pleasure to indulge and share my appetite with you as well.
Watch me! I got soul, and I'm super bad.
Jay Conner and I ate a whole lot more than just what you heard there. I'm talking cornbread with honey, peach cobbler, something called crazy cake. Man, oh man. Well, all right, Jay wrote about it, but we want to hear from you. What's your favorite soul food spot in SoCal? Tweet us. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two.
Sometimes I feel so nice. I want to try myself a few. I got soul, and I'm super bad. I'm love. I love to do my thing. And I don't need no one else. Sometimes I feel so nice.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I mean, Martinez. We all know educators have a lot to share with their students, but sometimes teaching can be a two-way street. There's a podcast called What My Students Taught Me that's exploring that very idea. It's created by the Teachers Project, an education reporting fellowship at Columbia Journalism School. Over the next 3 days, we'll hear from three very different Los Angeles teachers on valuable lessons they learned from their students. And we start with this story from English teacher Hazel Witham at Venice High School.
7 years ago, it was the first day of seventh grade at Daniel Webster Middle School on Los Angeles' west side. And English teacher Hazel Witham was reading the roster. The first name on the list was one usually used for a girl, but Hazel said it didn't seem quite right.
I kind of looked at him and he said, very playfully, "Can you call me Bob?"
Hazel went along.
And I was like, "Sure. Hi, Bob. Nice to meet you. I'm Miss Witham." And he came into class and that was when our relationship really started.
By the end of middle school, the student had come out as trans to his family and friends, and he began to identify as male. A couple years later, Hazel taught him again as a freshman at Venice High School. By this point, the student had permanently adopted a new name.
It was like, "Hey, so can you call me Drew?"
Hazel wanted to help Drew, who still encountered people who didn't want to use male pronouns, or call him by his new name.
I would correct colleagues. I would give them a little heads up. You need to be very careful. You need to tell substitute teachers what to call him. So in as many opportunities as presented themselves, I tried to be an advocate.
This meant a lot to Drew, who had never had that much support.
Truthfully, I feel like my relationship with Ms. Witham was the first relationship where I felt fully accepted.
By the time Drew was a junior, Hazel thought it might help him if he shared some of his experience transitioning at a spoken word poetry program. He wrote emotionally about his family's struggle to accept his new identity.
My poem was mainly about like my relationship with my mother and how she made me feel and how that still resonated with me. Like, "I'm your son. I know you wanted a daughter, but I'm your son. And like, I am me.
Hazel loved the poem, but she wanted to push Drew even further. She'd seen other coaches get in kids' faces and provoke them to draw out feeling. So when rehearsing one day, she decided to goad Drew a bit in an effort to help him. It did not go like she planned. Hazel decided to roleplay Drew's mother, who deeply upset him when she used his birth name.
I called him by his dead name, or his birth name. And so I said his dead name in an effort to push him to a new emotional place. He stopped. He looked at me like I had broken his heart and trust and was like, oh no, oh no.
It just really hurt. And I never thought I'd get to that point where I didn't feel safe with him.
Hazel apologized, but things weren't really the same between them for a while.
We reconciled to some degree, but it was still something that would be in the air for a little while.
Drew eventually forgave Hazel. He knew that her intent was good, even if her delivery was not.
I know I can trust her, and I know that she never means to hurt me.
In the end, he decided to participate in the slam. It was nothing like he imagined it would be.
It felt like really easy when I was up there, as opposed to like all the practices. All the practices were scary. I don't know why, but then I went and did it, and I felt really good about it.
And Hazel was there to cheer him on.
He just grabbed hold, and that was like this incredibly beautiful coming out to the world in a really public way.
Despite the happy ending, Hazel realizes that she could have lost Drew's trust forever that afternoon by pushing too hard. She's realized how much she has to learn about many of her students, and that means taking a step back and following their cues more.
They really are the ones that need to be in charge of their process as growing human beings. And it's my job to approach the work with curiosity rather than judgment.
For KPCC and the Teacher Project, I'm Ashley Okosa.
Tomorrow we hear from KPCC's Priska Neely. Finally now, we continue with our semi-regular series showcasing the unique sounds of Southern California. We have our latest Here in SoCal. That's H-E-A-R in SoCal. Now, if you're like most Angelenos, you probably drudged along the 210 freeway at some point, passing through the city of Arcadia, northeast of L.A. That's the location of a legendary sporting landmark that draws visitors from around the country. That bugle, it's what summons horses to the starting gate at Santa Anita Park. The racetrack opened on Christmas Day in 1934 and has attracted the likes of Hollywood legends ever since. Think Frank Sinatra, John Wayne, the Marx Brothers. Then there's the legendary racehorse, Seabiscuit. He won the Santa Anita Handicap in 1940, a groundbreaking race that set the stage for him to win the hearts of fans in Seabiscuit movies, starring Shirley Temple in 1949 and years later Jeff Bridges. Santa Anita Park was the location in both films.
Sure, he's small in the body, but big in the heart.
What do they call him?
Seabiscuit.
Wedged in the base of the San Gabriel Mountains, the track has come to symbolize tradition, luxury, athleticism, and the Olympics. Santa Anita Park played host to equestrian events at the 1984 Olympic Summer Games in Los Angeles. The track is still going strong. Races are run almost every weekend, weather permitting.
Put the pressure on Mo Boo. No breathers for Mo Boo.
On the far outside, Storms River is coming with a giant stride. Have to get to Shining Through. Shining Through takes the lead. Mirrorless comes through along the inside. And Storms River in the center of the court. Shining Through.
All right, as you've been hearing all throughout the show, we got you covered on social media. We want to hear about your favorite soul food spot in SoCal. You can tweet us. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. And then I got some pictures on my Instagram page from my visit earlier this morning at Western Town at Paramount Ranch, seeing all the sad damage there. You can find me at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. All right, we're back tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Tune in then.